Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. I'm always thinking about America and Ethiopia, about how the hybridization is going to work in both places. Ethiopian-born singer-songwriter Meklit Hedera was two when she and her two older sisters and her parents, both of whom are doctors, left Addis Ababa to come to the United States to escape the violence that followed Ethiopia's revolution in 1974. First stop, Iowa, and then it was on to New York. And it was during her adolescence in Brooklyn that Meklit first sang in choirs and was introduced to the music of Billie Holiday. Meklit continued singing while attending Yale University, where she earned a BA in political science. Then she headed west, eventually settling in San Francisco, where she began performing and developing her own sound, a combination of jazz, folk, and East African influences. In 2010, she released her solo album, On a Day Like This. She now has six, and her latest, When the People Move, the Music Moves Too. And, says Meklit, this is what happens when an Ethiopian family comes as refugees to the United States and makes social and cultural contributions in all kinds of ways. Named a TED Global Fellow in 2009 and a 2012 Senior Fellow, Meklit is the co-founder of both the Nile Project and the Arba Minch Collective. She's a featured voice on the UN Women theme song, One Women. She served as an artist in residence at NYU, inaugurated the UN Campaign for Gender Equality in Africa with a concert in Addis Ababa, and sits on the board of California's Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Time to meet this passionate, committed, creative woman. Meklit, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what does happen when an Ethiopian family comes as refugees to the United States? What was that like for you? And of course, I realize you were only a toddler when you arrived, but what did your parents impart to you? What was that like?
It was tough. It was really tough. I mean, our time in Iowa, we lived there for almost 4 years. And I call those our transition years to life in the United States. And really what it was for my parents was a lot of studying and trying to break into their work in science. They're both physicians and had to redo their residencies when we got to this country. And actually, one of my dad's college professors lived in Iowa, and we didn't know anyone else in this country. And he said, come on out and live with us. So we went to Iowa.
I don't know anybody in Iowa.
Isn't that funny? You never know where the path takes you.
Exactly.
So they were just studying, trying to pass the tests that you have to take to become eligible for residencies. And what I really saw was their struggle and their striving. They were really, really just trying to get their feet on the ground. It had gone from being successful medical doctors in Ethiopia to starting over from a place of not knowing the society. They did speak English fluently and they were educated. So we definitely were in a different place than many refugees are when they come here, although many are also educated. So that was our time in Iowa, kind of getting our feet on the ground. And then they both got residencies in New York, and that's what brought us there. And that was kind of when our engine in the U.S. really got going.
I can't imagine the culture shock. Forget coming from Ethiopia to the United States, which is massive, but then going from Iowa to Brooklyn. I'm trying to wrap my head around all of this, you know?
It was definitely a big change, but Brooklyn was so great for us. Not only were they able to begin practicing, which was just deeply important to them, and they're both so dedicated to science and just love medicine so much, but also we were immersed in a place where there were people from all over the world.
Exactly, yes.
And so that's really what my childhood was like, seeing that like deeply, deeply multicultural and actually entrepreneurial America.
So then what you're telling me was it really wasn't particularly difficult for you to find your place.
For me as a kid, I was just a kid, you know, so, and that's why I speak more about my parents' journey in the context of this particular conversation.
Sure.
We spoke Amharic in the household, which was my first language. And then when we went to school, starting in Iowa, that started to kind of fade away. At the same time, we were listening to a lot of Ethiopian music in the house while being obsessed with Michael Jackson and Prince and all of the things on American radio. So there was a lot of hybridization going on even from the beginning. For me, it was easier because I was so young and so flexible and so able to you know, just be myself in different environments. And we had a really wonderful community in Iowa even, and it was deeply supportive, and we came and they were very supportive of us, but there weren't many. So there was also a loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
My parents really, really missed, and I really missed without knowing what exactly I was missing, but the immersion in family.
And family. Oh, I bet.
That was a deep, deep loneliness that abated over the years as we found our ground and found our feet.
So I said in the introduction that when you came to New York, when you came to Brooklyn, is when you began to sing in choirs and kind of maybe get a greater sense of music. Talk about that once you found it. Did you know then that you met your match?
I always wanted to be a musician, and I felt, again, very lucky. And I think about music education and how important it is. I had one teacher. His name was Mr. Weidenfeld, and he was the choir teacher. And he made a tape of a Billie Holiday record for me. It was all hissy and scratchy. He said, "You have to listen to this. I think you're going to love it." And he let me be in the choir in sixth grade, even though you were supposed to be in seventh grade to be in it. And I always knew I had wanted to be a singer, but he was the first person who said, "I'll meet you there. You know,
wow.
I'll meet you in that dream. And we can walk a little bit of that path."
Well, then clearly he saw something in you.
I think he did. And, you know, I actually found him on Facebook recently and I was able to tell him, which was a wonderfully satisfying moment.
But in spite of having that experience of singing in choirs and being introduced to the likes of Billie Holiday, as I also said, you went on to Yale to study political science.
People love to ask that because it seems so diametrically opposed. But, but you know, for me, being a musician was not something that was in the realm of possibility. As an immigrant, as people who came to this country to have a better economic situation and a better life, you know, it's something that's not looked well upon. Don't go into something that has so much uncertainty. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's not that music isn't wonderful. So there was that pressure to choose something certain.
Mm.
And so studying at Yale, it wasn't even within the realm of my possibility that I could be a musician. So I studied liberal arts because really I just love to read and to write. And Yale was a place where I was able to explore my love of learning. And I literally would just spend hours and hours in the library chasing bibliography to bibliography, just reading completely outside of class and taking all sorts of classes and all sorts of subjects, learning about learning and exploring that place for the hall of knowledge that it is.
Then take us on this decision to leave the East Coast and go West, young woman.
My mom moved to Seattle when I graduated from high school because so many of my family had gone from Addis Ababa to Seattle in the meantime because I had this one aunt that just brought everybody. So I realized it was my chance to get to know my family for the first time. And after college, I went out there and I spent about a year and a half in Seattle getting to know them. But the rain was just too much for me. It was just so rainy all the time. So I said, oh, I'm an equatorial lady. I need the sun, you know? So I moved to San Francisco and I thought, okay, I can be close. And a bunch of my friends were moving there at the same time. I said, let me just try it.
What year was that?
That was 2004.
Okay.
But right away, I just met so many folks involved in the arts in this deeply, deeply inspiring and passionate and interdisciplinary and engaged way. And that was when I was like, I can do this.
Uh-huh.
I can really do this.
So you started, I guess, experimenting, right? I mean, did you know how to play an instrument? Who held your hand along the way?
I'd like to say that the community really did. And it was centered around a place called the Red Poppy Art House, which I actually ended up co-directing a few years after I got there. But it was like every step I took towards music took 10 steps towards me. And I'm a big applier. Like I just apply for stuff all the time. And that's something that I got via my education. So I found online this scholarship to the Blue Bear School of American Music, and they gave it to me, and I was 25 at the time, and it was for young people aged 12 to 25. And it's so funny, the photograph that they took of the winners of that year because I look like the lead singer of a child band. It's absolutely hilarious. I was like 1 month away from not being eligible, but they gave me money to study for a year at Blue Bear. So I studied guitar and I studied songwriting and I studied voice and I just dove in 100%.
So what made you think you had something to say musically?
The funny thing about a path, you know, you're kind of just going one foot in front of the other. So what I thought was, I know that I have this voice inside me telling me that I have to try this, and I didn't know what the result would be. So I came into that situation actually with no expectation. Even when I released my first album, I had no expectation about how successful or not successful it would be. It was more like, I have this thing and I have to get it out. I just have to get it out. And the result is not the point. And so it was like this desire to just express. And I started performing primarily at this place called the Mission Arts and Performance Project. And and people started coming. And I remember I had a show in 2007. And up until that point, it had been only my friends and family who would come to concerts. And then that time, there were all these people there. There was a line around the block, and I didn't know anyone in the audience. And I said, oh, maybe I can do this.
And so that kind of gave you the confidence, and that was the event that buoyed you to move on, because you felt that you also had something to say.
I felt I had a unique perspective that I didn't hear. I think that for me, I try to make the music that I wish I had when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Did you, in this time, had you been back to Ethiopia?
I had. I started going back to Ethiopia in 2001. And then I went every few years at that point since then. And then the intervals, I try to go every year, year and a half if I can. Sometimes a few more years go by, but I do try to go back often.
And so that quote that I used at the beginning of this introduction, that I'm always thinking about America and Ethiopia, about how the hybridization is going to work in both places. How has it worked in both places? Talk about that and its impact on you.
Well, it's been very interesting. You know, as I've released more and more albums and as I started touring, something that I wasn't expecting is that, you know, different Ethiopian communities, whether their different pockets of immigrant communities they would come to my shows and they would say, hey, you're representing us in a way that we haven't been represented before. Just keep on going. We're proud of you. Keep doing what you're doing. And I get that in Ethiopia quite a lot as well. And what I think is that there are very few images that we get to see of Ethiopian culture in the narrative of media. And there's so much focus on poverty and hopelessness.
Right, all this stereotyping. It's like one way only, you know?
Exactly, exactly. So when people get to see themselves as a person who expresses a story of love and longing, as somebody who is able to talk about culture and to engage people who are both from the United States or from Europe or from Africa or from Latin America, they say, that's really us. That's where we are complicated. We are intelligent. We are interesting. We are so many things that we don't get to say in these broader narratives. And they're like, we need more space for that. So it's not necessarily about me. It's actually about them. Mm-hmm. And that's been really beautiful. But they also rock along to the songs, you know?
So that solo album, On a Day Like This, what was the reception like? What was the response? Did you say, you know, man, I think I've got it?
Well, I just spent about 3 months being totally overwhelmed because right away before the album came out, this interview on NPR came out and they gave me like 18 minutes. And it just was like, it just lit this fire. And so it was just, I was doing tons of press. I started getting shows all over the country.
Wow.
Yeah, I ended up getting a booking agent months after the record was released, which was something I also hadn't thought was possible at the time. I started touring. It was a total blooming. it was very successful. And at the time I was with a label called Porto Franco Records, who were just, you know, 100% behind the album. And so it was definitely a kind of, it felt like a true release. You know what I mean? They say CD release. This felt like a release.
Well, the dynamic of the response and the fact that it was your first, I mean, I can't imagine that must have made your head spin.
Oh, my head was totally spinning. It was totally, totally spinning. It was honestly pretty disorienting because at the time, you know, now I have this wonderful community of internationally touring artists who I can, if I have a question, I can always just call them up and be like, hey, this kind of happened. What do you think of this? And, you know, I've worked with a team and management and agents for a long time now. I just have a lot more experience. But then it was just a very, very, it was a very new and confusing experience, but it was also thrilling and exhilarating. And it felt like I was telling a story that needed to be heard, and people were resonating with that. And so that felt really good as well.
And telling it in your own way, by virtue of the fact that you have this incredible, maybe can I call it an eclectic mix with jazz and folk and these Eastern African influences that makes you, I don't want to say an anomaly, but certainly makes you different.
Yeah, it is. I feel like there are a lot of people doing this kind of thing, but I don't hear this music in other places. I think that's going to change, actually. I think we're going to hear a lot more deeply, deeply, deeply hybrid music coming out of these cultural changes that we're all experiencing. And I'm actually really excited about that and what that looks like. But I think right now it looks like I'm unique. I'm actually not, but it looks like I'm unique because I'm part of this early wave.
Let's move a little bit from music for a second to some of these other credits to your name. A TED Global Fellow, a 2012 Senior Fellow. You co-founded the Nile Project, which I'd like you to talk about your international work. That's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you, Sandy. Yes, I became a TED Global Fellow in 2009. That was also something that I found an application for and spent 2 days or 3 days doing nothing but thinking about how to make that happen, because TED was such an inspiration to me and remains such an inspiration to me and has actually become a major, major part of my life over the last several years. For me, you know, I have this side of me that's deeply musical, but I really like to think about how artists coming together can affect change, can broaden the stories, can tell new stories, can inspire people to think differently, and how it can and how it really has a place in any culture that's working on finding our way through this very challenging 21st century that we're all about to have. So in 2009, I became a TED Global Fellow for my work with the Arbamensch Collective. I had founded a group of Ethiopian diaspora artists to travel collectively to Ethiopia biannually to connect with arts and culture institutions and also traditional and contemporary movers and shakers over in Addis Ababa. That was something that I gave a TED talk about in 2009. And in 2012, I became a TED Senior Fellow for my work with the Nile Project, which brought together musicians from the 11 countries of the Nile Basin to create music together and to inspire Nile citizens to think about the river as a single ecosystem, and also think about the way that how well you know your neighbor, how well your cultural and social relationships across Nile borders goes. You know, the better it is, the more we're able to think about how we share resources and how we manage and work with this river that really defines much of the Eastern African continent, but also that is going to be under all kinds of climate pressure in the next 100 years. So culture and social relationships and the developments of those can be deeply important in our ecology. So it's really about the intersection of culture and ecology. The Nile Project continues on today. It's actually now working much more with East African universities and with young people in universities across the Nile Basin, creating a Nile Fellowship. So it's connections between university students as well over there. I'm a little bit less involved these days. It was my primary work for about three and a half years, but also it's being run, and it was my other co-founder is Mina Girgis, who's an Egyptian ethnomusicologist, and that project has become his whole work in life.
Whoa, as I sit here with my jaw dropping. Wow. Also, in that same breath. No, it's really impressive. In the same breath, talk about, you know, another significant project, the UN Campaign for Gender Equality in Africa. You held a concert in Ethiopia. What was that about?
Well, you know, the UN invited me over there to, basically, they were starting this project, a campaign for gender equity across Africa, and they asked me to be a part of it. It happened to dovetail perfectly with some other conferences that I was attending over there. I was attending the African Leadership Conference over there, also bringing together incredible movers and shakers from across the continent. And so I did a dual trip, both working with the ALA conference, as well as doing this conference with the UN and performing there, and really letting the campaign be like, hey, this is a celebration. We need to celebrate women. It's about rights, but it's also about celebrating and shining and holding them up and really making space for women and for this campaign over the next year. So that was in 2011.
And all these good works, you just must feel so proud of yourself because they make a difference, right? I mean, they're impactful.
You know, I really thank you, Sandy. That's really sweet of you and kind of you to say. For me, we started this conversation thinking about my parents and that transition to the U.S. And what I will say is what my parents modeled for me, and I will say also what Ethiopian culture models for me, is just like, you just got to keep working. Like, you just keep on going. Like, there is always more work to do, and you just got to do your part, whatever your part is. So for me, I'm always thinking about what more is there to do and how can we keep.
Well, clearly they set the bar very high. What role models you have.
Yes, yes. My parents are my inspirations. They never cease to amaze me with their continued expansion as physicians. And they always keep learning and keep trying to grow in their own medical practice. And so, yes, they're definitely my deep role models.
Tell me about the genesis of this album, When the People Move, the Music Moves Too.
I was in Ethiopia in 2011, and Dr. Mulatu Astatke, who's the godfather of Ethio jazz, he basically created Ethiopian jazz in the 1960s. And he's one of my mentors and my heroes. And in 2011, I met him in Addis, and he came to a concert of mine, and he kind of took me aside afterwards, and he said, hey, you know, I really like what you're doing, but listen, why are you playing Ethio jazz like we played it 40 years ago? He said, your job is to find out what your contribution is to this music. You got to just find your way through, give different things a try, figure it out. What's your contribution, your unique contribution that only you can make? Now go do that.
There's a challenge.
That's exactly the word I use. I say he took me to task and he tasked me. He gave me a task. And I was honestly overwhelmed by that conversation. And I sat there for 2 years thinking about it. How can I do that? What does he mean? And actually, as through my touring with the Nile Project and spending a lot of time with these incredible traditional musicians, as well as Ethio jazz musicians, and just getting deeper into my own songwriting practice, I started to understand. I wrote a grant to support that from the MAP Fund, which is a wonderful organization based out of New York, and they commissioned me to write this music. And I spent about 2 years then writing this music. And so this is all about Ethio jazz for 2017. And it came from that conversation with one of the heroes of Ethio jazz, Mulatu Astatke. And what I was thinking about, though, and what I realized is that I could only tell that story, I could only give my perspective from my experiences, which is when music is authentic, when it comes from your experiences. And mine are also come from a place of being a singer-songwriter, as well as a jazz singer, and being Ethiopian. And so I think in the past, my albums have been like, oh, well, one song is more Ethiopian, one song is more singer-songwriter, one song is more American jazz. And in this album, what I really tried to do was bring every single influence into every single song and create something where an American audience may say, oh, wow, well, these rhythms are kind of unusual to me and the melody is kind of unusual, but she's strumming a guitar and she's telling a story in the way that Joni Mitchell might, like, I you can grasp onto it because I love to play with this mix of the familiar and the unfamiliar. And an Ethiopian audience, they have a different understanding of familiar and unfamiliar, but they get it. They're like, oh, I understand that rhythm. I know how to dance to it. But at the same time, the story is something I don't quite understand, or the vocal style definitely comes from American jazz, or the vocal style comes from a singer-songwriter thing. So I'm always playing with this mix of familiar and unfamiliar on this record. And that's also what I meant by the hybridization and how it works in both Ethiopia and the United States. So I made something, and I was striving to make something that was so, so deeply of both places that actually it belongs in this time. It could only be made in the 21st century. This is music for 2017, for where we are now as a culture, and for the kinds of global movements of people that we have seen, that I am a part of from an early wave, as I mentioned. But also, we're going to keep seeing all of these cultural shifts coming from global movements of people. And it's not something to be afraid of. It's not something to be afraid of. It's something to dance to.
So clearly, what you didn't say, and I will, is that we need this album.
Well, only you can say that, Sandy.
Yes, I can. This album was produced by Dan Wilson, who has quite a lot of street cred, that he's worked with Adele and Taylor Swift and John Legend. That must have been pretty heady for you as well.
That was like the biggest thrill of my life. I met him at TED in 2013, and we just spent the week at TED talking about music and talking about ideas, and we're like, oh, man. Yeah. And we kept hanging out over. When I would go to LA, we'd get together and just have coffee. And finally, 2 years later, I had the courage to ask him, hey, you want to work on something together? And and he was totally into it. And he is a songwriting genius. And the feedback he gave me sharpened these songs in a way that I can't even tell you. And he co-wrote two of them with me. It was an incredible experience. It was the musical experience of my life to work with him.
Wow. Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to end this conversation with one of the selections, When the People Move, the Music Moves Too. And I'm going to select Birthday Song, because I somehow think that makes the most sense based on this conversation. Not in the sense of a rebirth, but there's just something in a way that's connected to it in terms of what you've been doing and what your career is like. And I seem to say this with such frequency at the end of my conversations. Wow, it was so my pleasure to meet and get to know you. We need you. We need the McLeets. Really, it's just so wonderful. And thank God you dumped the poli sci degree. You know? Well, I don't really mean that, but, you know, and that you're making beautiful, wonderful, important music.
Thank you so much, Sandy. I really appreciate it.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Happy.